Dogfight, narrated by Oliver Wyman.
He meant to keep on going, right down to Florida. Work passage on a gun runner, maybe wind up conscripted into some rat-ass rebel army down in the war zone. Or maybe, with that ticket good as long as he didn't stop riding, he'd just never get off. Greyhound's Flying Dutchman. He grinned at his faint reflection in cold, greasy glass while the downtown lights of Norfolk slid past, the bus swaying on tired shocks as the driver slung it around a final corner. They shuddered to a halt in the terminal lot, concrete lit gray and harsh, like a prison exercise yard. But Deke was watching himself starve, maybe in some snowstorm out of Oswego, with his cheek pressed up against that same bus window, and seeing his remains swept out at the next stop by a muttering old man in faded coveralls. One way or the other, he decided, it didn't mean shit to him. Except his leg seemed to have died already, and the driver called a 20-minute stopover, Tidewater Station, Virginia. It was an old cinder-block building with two entrances to each restroom, holdover from the previous century. Legs like wood, he made a half-hearted attempt at ghosting the notions counter, but the black girl behind it was alert, guarding the sparse contents of the old glass case as though her ass depended on it. Probably does, Deke thought, turning away. Opposite the washrooms, an open doorway offered games, the word flickering feebly in biofluorescent plastic. He could see a crowd of the local kickers clustered around a pool table. Aimless, his boredom following him like a cloud, he stuck his head in, and saw a biplane, wings no longer than his thumb, blossom bright orange flame. Corkscrewing, trailing smoke, it vanished the instant it struck the green felt field of the table.
"That's right, Tiny," a kicker bellowed. "You take that sumbitch!"
"Hey," Deke said, "what's going on?" The nearest kicker was a beanpole with a black mesh Peterbilt cap.
"Tiny's defending the Max," he said, not taking his eyes from the table.
"Oh, yeah? What's that?" But even as he asked, he saw it. A blue enamel medal, shaped like a Maltese cross, the slogan, "Pour le Mérite," divided among its arms. The blue Max rested on the edge of the table, directly before a vast and perfectly immobile bulk wedged into a fragile-looking chrome tube chair. The man's khaki work shirt would have hung on Deke like the folds of a sail, but it bulged across that bloated torso so tautly that the buttons threatened to tear away at any instant. Deke thought of Southern troopers he'd seen on his way down, of that weird, gut-heavy endotype balanced on gangly legs that looked like they'd been borrowed from some other body. Tiny might look like that if he stood, but on a larger scale, a 40-inch jeans inseam that would need a woven steel waistband to support all those pounds of swollen gut, if Tiny were ever to stand at all. For now, Deke saw that that shiny frame was actually a wheelchair. There was something disturbingly childlike about the man's face, an appalling suggestion of youth and even beauty in features almost buried in fold and jowl. Embarrassed, Deke looked away. The other man, the one standing across the table from Tiny, had bushy sideburns and a thin mouth. He seemed to be trying to push something with his eyes, wrinkles of concentration spreading from the corners.
"You dumb shit or what?"
The man with the Peterbilt cap turned, catching Deke's Indo-Prolboy denims, the brass chains at his wrists, for the first time.
"Why don't you get your ass lost, fucker? Nobody wants your kind in here."
He turned back to the dogfight. Bets were being made, being covered. The kickers were producing the hard stuff, the old stuff. Liberty-headed dollars and Roosevelt dimes from the stamp and coin stores. while more cautious bettors slapped down antique paper dollars laminated in clear plastic. Through the haze came a trio of red planes flying in formation. Fokker D-7s. The room fell silent. The Fokkers banked majestically under the solar orb of a 200-watt bulb. The blue Spad dove out of nowhere. Two more plunged from the shadowy ceiling, following closely. The kickers swore, and one chuckled. The formation broke wildly. One Fokker dove almost to the felt without losing the Spad on its tail. Furiously, it zigged and zagged across the green flatlands, but to no avail. At last it pulled up, the enemy hard after it, too steeply, and stalled, too low to pull out in time. A stack of silver dimes was scooped up. The Fokkers were outnumbered now. One had two Spads on its tail. A needle spray of tracers tore past its cockpit. The Fokker slip-turned right, banked into an Immelmann, and was behind one of its pursuers. It fired, and the biplane fell, tumbling.
Way to go, Tiny!
The kickers closed in around the table. Deke was frozen with wonder. It felt like being born all over again. Frank's truck stop was 2 miles out of town on the commercial vehicles-only route. Deke had tagged it, out of idle habit, from the bus on the way in. Now he walked back between the traffic and the concrete crash guards. Articulated trucks went slamming past big, eight-segmented jobs, the wash of air each time threatening to blast him over. CVO stops were easy makes. When he sauntered into Frank's, there was nobody to doubt that he'd come in off a big rig, and he was able to browse the gift shop as slowly as he liked. The wire rack with the projective wetware wafers was located between a stack of Korean cowboy shirts and a display for Fuzzbuster mudguards. A pair of Oriental dragons twisted in the air over the rack, either fighting or fucking. He couldn't tell which. The game he wanted was there, a wafer labeled Spads and Fokkers. It took him 3 seconds to boost it, and less time to slide the magnet, which the cops in D.C. hadn't even bothered to confiscate, across the Universal Security Strip. On the way out, he lifted 2 programming units and a little Batang facilitator remote that looked like an antique hearing aid. He chose a high stack at random and fed the rental agent the line he'd used since his welfare rights were yanked. Nobody ever checked up. The state just counted occupied rooms and paid. The cubicle smelled faintly of urine, and someone had scrawled hard Anarchy Liberation Front slogans across the walls. Deke kicked trash out of a corner, sat down, back to the wall, and ripped open the wafer pack. There was a folded instruction sheet with diagrams of loops, rolls, and Immelmanns, a tube of saline paste, and a computer list of operational specs. And the wafer itself, white plastic with a blue biplane and logo on one side, red on the other. He turned it over and over in his hand. Spads and Fokkers, Fokkers and Spads. Red or blue. He fitted the Batang behind his ear after coating the inductor surface with paste, jacked its fiber optic ribbon into the programmer, and plugged the programmer into the wall current. Then he slid the wafer into the programmer. It was a cheap set, Indonesian, and the base of his skull buzzed uncomfortably as the program ran. But when it was done, a sky-blue Spad darted restlessly through the air, a few inches from his face. It almost glowed, it was so real. It had the strange inner life that fanatically detailed museum-grade models often have, but it took all of his concentration to keep it in existence. If his attention wavered at all, it lost focus, fuzzing into a pathetic blur. He practiced until the battery in the ear set died, then slumped against the wall and fell asleep. He dreamed of flying, in a universe that consisted entirely of white clouds and blue sky, with no up and down, and never a green field to crash into. He woke to a rancid smell of frying krill cakes and winced with hunger. No cash, either. Well, there were plenty of student types in the stack, bound to be one who'd like to score a programming unit. He hit the hall with the boosted spare. Not far down was a door with a poster on it. There's a hell of a good universe next door. Under that was a starscape with a cluster of multicolored pills, torn from an ad for some pharmaceutical company, pasted over an inspirational shot of the space colony that had been under construction since before he was born. "Let's go," the poster said, beneath the collaged hypnotics. He knocked. The door opened, security slides stopping it at a 2-inch slice of girl face. "Yeah?" "You're going to think this is stolen." He passed the programmer from hand to hand. "I mean, because it's new, virtual cherry, and the barcode's still on it. But listen, I'm not going to argue the point. No. I'm going to let you have it for only, like, half what you'd pay anywhere else."
"Hey, wow, really? No kidding?"
The visible fraction of mouth twisted into a strange smile. She extended her hand, palm up, a loose fist, level with his chin.
"Look a here."
There was a hole in her hand, a black tunnel that ran right up her arm. 2 small red lights. Rat's eyes. They scurried toward him, growing, gleaming. Something gray streaked forward and leaped for his face. He screamed, throwing hands up to ward it off. Legs twisting, he fell, the programmer shattering under him. Silicate shards skittered as he thrashed, clutching his head. Where it hurt, it hurt. It hurt very badly indeed.
"Oh my God!"
Slides unsnapped, and the girl was hovering over him.
"Here, listen, come on." She dangled a blue hand towel. "Grab onto this and I'll pull you up."
He looked at her through a wash of tears. Student. That fed look. The oversized sweatshirt, teeth so straight and white they could be used as a credit reference. A thin gold chain around one ankle, fuzzed, he saw, with baby-fine hair. Choppy Japanese haircut. Money. "That sucker was going to be my dinner," he said ruefully. He took hold of the towel and let her pull him up. She smiled, but skittishly backed away from him.
"Let me make it up to you," she said. "You want some food? It was only a projection, okay?"
He followed her in, wary as an animal entering a trap. "Holy shit," Deke said. "This is real cheese." He was sitting on a gut-sprung sofa, wedged between a 4-foot teddy bear and a loose stack of floppies. The room was ankle-deep in books and clothes and papers, but the food she magicked up, Gouda cheese and tinned beef and honest-to-God greenhouse wheat wafers, was straight out of the Arabian Nights.
"Hey," she said, "we know how to treat a prole boy right, huh?"
Her name was Nance Bettendorf. She was 17. Both her parents had jobs, greedy buggers, and she was an engineering major at William & Mary. She got top marks, except in English.
"I guess you must really have a thing about rats. You got some kind of a phobia about rats?"
He glanced sidelong at her bed. You couldn't see it, really. It was just a swell in the ground cover. "It's not like that. It just reminded me of something else, is all."
"Like what?"
She squatted in front of him, the big shirt riding high up one smooth thigh. "Well, did you ever see the..." His voice involuntarily rose and rushed past the words. "Washington Monument? Like at night? It's got these 2 little red lights on top, aviation markers or something, and I... He started to shake.
"You're afraid of the Washington Monument?"
Nance whooped and rolled over with laughter, long, tanned legs kicking. She was wearing crimson bikini panties. I would die rather than look at it again, he said levelly. She stopped laughing then, sat up, studied his face. White, even teeth worried at her lower lip, like she was dragging up something she didn't want to think about. At last, she ventured, Brainlock? Yeah, he said bitterly. They told me I'd never go back to D.C. And then the fuckers laughed.
What did they get you for?
I'm a thief.
He wasn't about to tell her that the actual charge was career shoplifting.
A lot of old computer hacks spent their lives programming machines, and you know what? The human brain is not a goddamn bit like a machine, no way. They just don't program the same.
Deke knew this shrill, desperate rap, this long, circular jive that the lonely string out to the rare listener, knew it from 100 cold and empty nights spent in the company of strangers. Nance was lost in it, and Deke, nodding and yawning, wondered if he'd even be able to stay awake when they finally hit that bed of hers.
I built that projection I hit you with myself, she said, hugging her knees up beneath her chin. It's for muggers, you know. I just happened to have it on me, and I threw it at you because I thought it was so funny, you trying to sell me that shit little Indo-Javanese programmer.
She hunched forward and held out her hand again.
Look here. Deke cringed. No, no, it's okay. I swear it. This is different.
She opened her hand. A single blue flame danced there, perfect and ever-changing.
Look at that, she marveled. Just look. I programmed that. It's not some diddly little seven-image job, either. It's a continuous two-hour loop, 7,200 seconds, never the same twice, each instant as individual as a fucking snowflake.
The flame's core was glacial crystal, shards and facets flashing up, twisting and gone, leaving behind near-subliminal images so bright and sharp that they cut the eye. Deke winced. People, mostly. Pretty little naked people. Fucking. How the hell did you do that? She rose, bare feet slipping on slick magazines, and melodramatically swept folds of loose printout from a raw plywood shelf. He saw a neat row of small consoles, austere and expensive-looking. Custom work.
This is the real stuff I got here. Image facilitator. Here's my fast wipe module. This is a brain map one-to-one function analyzer.
She sang off the names like a litany.
Quantum flicker stabilizer, program splicer, an image assembler. You need all that to make one little flame? You betcha. This is all state-of-the-art professional projective wetware gear. It's years ahead of anything you've seen.
Hey, he said, you know anything about spads and Fokkers? She laughed, and then, because he sensed the time was right, he reached out to take her hand.
Don't you touch me, motherfucker! Don't you ever touch me!
Nance screamed, and her head slammed against the wall as she recoiled, white and shaking with terror.
Okay, he threw up his hands. Okay, I'm nowhere near you, okay?
She cowered from him. Her eyes were round and unblinking. Tears built up at the corners, rolled down ashen cheeks. Finally, she shook her head.
Hey, Deke, sorry. I should have told you.
Told me what? But he had a creepy feeling, already knew. The way she clutched her head, the weakly spasmodic way her hands opened and closed.
You got a brain lock, too.
Yeah, she closed her eyes.
It's a chastity lock. My asshole parents paid for it. So I can't stand to have anybody touch me or even stand too close.
Eyes opened in blind hate.
I didn't even do anything. Not a fucking thing. but they've both got jobs and they're so horny for me to have a career that they can't piss straight. They're afraid I'd neglect my studies if I got, you know, involved in sex and stuff. The day the brain lock comes off, I am going to fuck the vilest, greasiest, hairiest... She was clutching her head again. Deke jumped up and rummaged through the medicine cabinet. He found a jar of B-complex vitamins, pocketed a few against need, and brought two to Nance with a glass of water. Here. He was careful to keep his distance. This'll take the edge off.
Yeah, yeah,
she said. Then, almost to herself,
you must really think I'm a jerk.
The games room in the Greyhound station was almost empty. A lone, long-jawed 14-year-old was bent over a console, maneuvering rainbow fleets of submarines in the murky grid of the North Atlantic. Deke sauntered in, wearing his new kicker drag, and leaned against a cinder-block wall made smooth by countless coats of green enamel. He'd washed the dye from his pro-boy Butch, boosted jeans and T-shirt from the Goodwill, and found a pair of stompers in the sauna locker of a high stack with cut-rate security. Seen Tiny around, friend? The subs darted like neon guppies.
Depends on who's asking.
Deke touched the remote behind his left ear. The SPAD snap-rolled over the console, swift and delicate as a dragonfly. It was beautiful. So perfect, so true, it made the room seem an illusion. He buzzed the grid, millimeters from the glass, taking advantage of the programmed ground effect. The kid didn't even bother to look up.
Jackman's, he said. Down Richmond Road, over by the surplus.
Deke let the SPAD fade in mid-climb. Jackman's took up most of the third floor of an old brick building. Deke found Best Buy War Surplus first, then a broken neon sign over an unlit lobby. The sidewalk out front was littered with another kind of surplus. Damaged vets, some of them dating back to Indochina. Old men who'd left their eyes under Asian suns squatted beside twitching boys who'd inhaled mycotoxins in Chile. Deke was glad to have the battered elevator doors sigh shut behind him. A dusty Dr. Pepper clock at the far side of the long, spectral room told him it was 7:45. Jackman's had been embalmed 20 years before he was born, sealed away behind a yellowish film of nicotine, of polish and hair oil. Directly beneath the clock, the flat eyes of somebody's grandpappy's prize buck regarded Deke from a framed, blown-up snapshot, gone the slick sepia of cockroach wings. There was the click and whisper of pool, the squeak of a work boot twisting on linoleum as a player leaned in for a shot. Somewhere high above the green-shaded lamps hung a string of crepe-paper Christmas bells, faded to dead rose. Deke looked from one cluttered wall to the next. No facilitator.
"Bring one in should we need it," someone said.
He turned, meeting the mild eyes of a bald man with steel-rimmed glasses.
"My name's Klein, Bobby Earl. You don't look like you shoot pool, mister."
But there was nothing threatening in Bobby Earl's voice or stance. He pinched the steel frames from his nose and polished the thick lenses with a fold of tissue. He reminded Deke of a shop instructor who'd patiently tried to teach him retrograde biochip installation. "I'm a gambler," he said, smiling. His teeth were white plastic.
"I know I don't much look it."
"I'm looking for Tiny," Deke said.
"Well," replacing the glasses, "you're not going to find him. He's gone up to Bethesda to let the VA clean his plumbing for him. He wouldn't fly against you anyhow."
"Why not?"
"Well, because you're not on the circuit, or I'd know your face. You any good?"
When Deke nodded, Bobby Earl called down the length of Jackman's.
"Yo, Clarence, you bring out that facilitator. We got us a flyboy."
20 minutes later, Having lost his remote and what cash he had left, Deke was striding past the broken soldiers of Best Buy.
"Now you let me tell you, boy," Bobby Earle had said in a fatherly tone as, hand on shoulder, he led Deke back to the elevator. "You're not going to win against a combat vet. You listening to me? I'm not even especially good, just an old grunt who was on hype 15, maybe 20 times. Old Tiny, he was a pilot. Spent his entire enlistment hyped to the gills. He's got membrane attenuation real bad. You ain't never going to beat him."
It was a cool night, but Deke burned with anger and humiliation.
"Jesus, that's crude," Nance said as the Spad strafed mounds of pink underwear.
Deke, hunched up on the couch, yanked her flashy little brawn remote from behind his ear.
"Now don't you get on my case, too, Miss Rich Bitch gonna have a job. Hey, lighten up. It's nothing to do with you. It's just tech. That's a really primitive wafer you got there. I mean, on the street, maybe it's fine. But compared to the work I do at school, it's... Hey, you want to let me rewrite it for you?"
"Say what?"
"Let me beef it up. These suckers are all written in hexadecimal, see? 'Cause the industry programmers are all washed-out computer hacks. That's how they think. But let me take it to the reader analyzer at the department, run a few changes on it, translate it into a modern wet language, edit out all the redundant intermediaries. That'll goose up your reaction time, cut the feedback loop in half. So you'll fly faster and better. Turn you into a real pro, Ace."
She took a hit off her bong, then doubled over, laughing and choking.
"Is that legit?" Deke asked dubiously. "Hey, why do you think people buy gold wire remotes? For the prestige? Shit. Conductivity's better, cuts a few nanoseconds off the reaction time. And reaction time is the name of the game, kiddo."
"No," Deke said. "If it were that easy, people would already have it. Tiny Montgomery would have it. He'd have the best."
"Don't you ever listen?"
Nance set down the bong. Brown water slopped onto the floor.
"The stuff I'm working with is 3 years ahead of anything you'll find on the street."
"No shit," Deke said after a long pause. "I mean, you can do that?" It was like graduating from a Model T to a 93 Lotus. The Spad handled like a dream, responsive to Deke's slightest thought. For weeks he played the arcades with not a nibble. He flew against the local teams and by ones and threes shot down their planes. He took chances, played flash, and the planes tumbled. Until one day, Deke was tucking his seed money away, and a lanky black straightened up from the wall. He eyed the laminateds in Deke's hand and grinned. A ruby tooth gleamed.
"You know," the man said, "I heard there was a Casper who could fly going up against the kiddies."
"Jesus," Deke said, spreading Danish butter on a kelp stick. "I wiped the floor with those spades. They were good, too."
"That's nice, honey," Nance mumbled. She was working on her finals project, sweating data into a machine. "You know, I think what's happening is I got real talent for this kind of shit, you know? I mean, the program gives me an edge, but I got the stuff to take advantage of it. I'm really getting a rep out there, you know?"
Impulsively, he snapped on the radio. Scratchy Dixieland brass blared.
"Hey," Nance said, "do you mind?"
"No, I'm just..." He fiddled with the knobs, came up with some slow, romantic bullshit. "There. Come on, stand up. Let's dance."
"Hey, you know I can't..." "Sure you can, sugar cakes."
He threw her the huge teddy bear and snatched up a patchwork cotton dress from the floor. He held it by the waist and sleeve, tucking the collar under his chin. It smelled of patchouli, more faintly of sweat. "See? I stand over here, you stand over there. We dance. Get it?" Blinking softly, Nance stood and clutched the bear tightly. They danced then, slowly, staring into each other's eyes. After a while, she began to cry. But still, she was smiling. Deke was daydreaming, imagining he was Tiny Montgomery wired into his jump jet. Imagined the machine responding to his slightest neural twitch, reflexes cranked way up, hype flowing steadily into his veins. Nance's floor became jungle, her bed a plateau in the Andean foothills, and Deke flew his SPAD at forced speed, as if it were a full-wired interactive combat machine. Computer hypos fed a slow trickle of high-performance enhancement melange into his bloodstream. Sensors were wired directly into his skull, pulling a supersonic snap turn in the green-blue bowl of sky over Bolivian rainforest. Tiny would have felt the airflow over control surfaces. Below, grunts hacked through the jungle with hype pumps strapped above elbows to give them that little extra death dance fury in combat, a shot of liquid hell in a blue plastic vial. Maybe they got 10 minutes worth in a week. But coming in at treetop level, reflexes cranked to the max, flying so low the ground troops never spotted you until you were on them, Phosgene agents released, away and gone before they could draw a bead. It took a constant trickle of hype just to maintain, and the direct neuron interface with the jump jet was a two-way street. The onboard computers monitored biochemistry and decided when to open the sluice gates and give the human component a killer jolt of combat edge. Dosages like that ate you up, ate you good and slow and constant, etching the brain surfaces, eroding away the brain cell membranes. If you weren't yanked from the air promptly enough, you ended up with brain cell attenuation, with reflexes too fast for your body to handle, and your fight-or-flight reflexes fucked real good.
I aced it, Pro Boy!
Huh? Deke looked up, startled as Nance slammed in, tossing books and bag onto the nearest heap.
My finals project. I got exempted from exams. The prof said he'd never seen anything like it. Hey, dim the lights, would you? The colors are weird on my eyes.
He obliged. So show me. Show me this wonderful thing.
Yeah, okay.
She snatched up his remote, kicked clear standing space atop the bed, and struck a pose. A spark flared into flame in her hand. It spread in a quicksilver line up her arm, around her neck, and it was a snake, with triangular head and flickering tongue. Molten colors, oranges and reds. It slithered between her breasts.
I call it a fire snake, she said proudly.
Deke leaned close, and she jerked back. Sorry. It's like your flame, huh? I mean, I can see these tiny little fuckers in it.
Sort of.
The fire snake flowed down her stomach.
Next month I'm going to splice 200 separate flame programs together with meld justification in between to get the visuals. Then I'll tap the mind's body image to make it self-orienting, so it can crawl all over your body without your having to mind it. You could wear it dancing.
Maybe I'm dumb, but if you haven't done the work yet, how come I can see it? Nance giggled.
That's the best part. Half the work isn't done yet. Didn't have the time to assemble the pieces into a unified program. Turn on that radio, huh? I want to dance.
She kicked off her shoes. Deke tuned in something gutsy, then, at Nance's urging, turned it down, almost to a whisper.
I scored 2 hits of hype, see?
She was bouncing on the bed, weaving her hands like a Balinese dancer.
Ever try this stuff? Incredible. Gives you, like, absolute concentration. Look here.
She stood on point.
Never done that before.
Hype. Deke said. Last person I heard of got caught with that shit got 3 years in the infantry. How'd you score it?
Cut a deal with a vet who was in grad school. She bombed out last month. Stuff gives me perfect visualization. I can hold the projection with my eyes shut. It was a snap assembling the program in my head.
On just two hits, huh?
One hit. I'm saving the other. Teach was so impressed, he's sponsoring me for a job interview. A recruiter from IG Fjukvarn hits campus in 2 weeks. That cap is going to sell him the program and me. I'm going to cut out of school 2 years early, straight into industry, do not pass jail, do not pay $200.
The snake curled into a flaming tiara. It gave Deke a funny, creepy feeling to think of Nance walking out of his life.
I'm a witch, Nance sang, a wetware witch.
She shucked her shirt over her head and sent it flying. Her fine, high breasts moved freely, gracefully, as she danced.
I'm gonna make it!
Now she was singing a current pop hit.
To the top!
Her nipples were small and pink and aroused. The fire snake licked at them and whipped away. Hey, Nance, Deke said uncomfortably. Calm down a little, huh?
I'm celebrating!
She'd hooked a thumb into her shiny gold panties. Fire swirled around hand and crotch.
I'm the virgin goddess, baby, and I have the power.
Singing again. Deke looked away. Gotta go now, he mumbled. Gotta go home and jerk off. He wondered where she'd hidden that second hit. Could be anywhere. There was a protocol to the circuit, a tacit order of deference and precedence as elaborate as that of a Mandarin court. It didn't matter that Deke was hot, that his rep was spreading like wildfire. Even a name flyboy couldn't just challenge whom he wished. He had to climb the ranks. But if you flew every night, if you were always available to anybody's challenge, and if you were good, well, it was possible to climb fast. Deke was one plane up. It was tournament fighting, three planes against three. Not many spectators, a dozen maybe, but it was a good fight, and they were noisy. Deke was immersed in the manic calm of combat when he realized suddenly that they had fallen silent. Saw the kickers stir and exchange glances. Eyes flicked past him. He heard the elevator doors close. Coolly, he disposed of the second of his opponent's planes, then risked a quick glance over his shoulder. Tiny Montgomery had just entered Jackman's. The wheelchair whispered across browning linoleum, guided by tiny twitches of one imperfectly paralyzed hand. His expression was stern, blank, calm. In that instant, Deke lost two planes, one to deresolution, gone to blur and canceled out by the facilitator, and the other because his opponent was a real fighter. Guy did a barrel roll, killing speed and slipping to the side, and strafed Deke's biplane as it shot past. It went down in flames. Their last two planes shared altitude and speed, and as they turned, trying for position, they naturally fell into a circling pattern. The kickers made room as Tiny wheeled up against the table. Bobby Earl Klein trailed after him, lanky and casual. Deke and his opponent traded glances and pulled their machines back from the pool table so they could hear the man out. Tiny smiled. His features were small, clustered in the center of his pale, doughy face. One finger twitched slightly on the chrome handrest.
I heard about you.
He looked straight at Deke. His voice was soft and shockingly sweet, a baby girl little voice.
I heard you're good.
Deke nodded slowly. The smile left Tiny's face. His soft, fleshy lips relaxed into a natural pout, as if he were waiting for a kiss. His small, bright eyes studied Deke without malice.
Let's see what you can do, then.
Deke lost himself in the cool game of war.
and when the enemy went down in smoke and flame to explode and vanish against the table, Tiny wordlessly turned his chair, wheeled it into the elevator, and was gone. As Deke was gathering up his winnings, Bobby Earl eased up to him and said, "The man wants to play you." "Yeah?" Deke was nowhere near high enough on the circuit to challenge Tiny. "What's the scam?" "Man who was coming up from Atlanta tomorrow canceled. Old Tiny, he was spoiling to go up against somebody new. So it looks like you get your shot at the max." "Tomorrow? Wednesday? Doesn't give me much prep time." Bobby Earl smiled gently.
"I don't think that makes no never mind."
"How's that, Mr. Klein?"
"Boy, you just ain't got the moves, you follow me? Ain't got no surprises. You fly just like some kind of beginner, only faster and slicker. You follow what I'm trying to say?"
"I'm not sure I do. You want to put a little action on that?"
"Tell you truthful," Klein said, "I've been hoping on that."
He drew a small black notebook from his pocket and licked a pencil stub. "Give you 5-1.
They's nobody gonna give no fairer odds than that."
He looked at Deke almost sadly.
"But Tiny, he's just naturally better'n you. And that's all she wrote, boy. He lives for that goddamn game. Ain't got nothing else. Can't get out of that goddamn chair. You think you can best a man who's fighting for his life? You are just lying to yourself."
Norman Rockwell's portrait of the colonel regarded Deke dispassionately from the Kentucky Fried across Richmond Road from the coffee bar. Deke held his cup with hands that were cold and trembling. His skull hummed with fatigue. "Klein was right," he told the colonel. "I can go up against Tiny, but I can't win." The colonel stared back, gaze calm and level, and not particularly kindly, taking in the coffee bar and Best Buy and all his drag-ass kingdom of Richmond Road, waiting for Deke to admit to the terrible thing he had to do.
"The bitch is planning to leave me anyway," Deke said aloud,
which made the black counter girl look at him funny, then quickly away.
"Daddy called."
Nance danced into the apartment, slamming the door behind her.
"And you know what? He says if I can get this job and hold it for 6 months, he'll have the brain lock reversed. Can you believe it? Deke?"
She hesitated.
"You okay?"
Deke stood. Now that the moment was on him, he felt unreal, like he was in a movie or something.
"How come you never came home last night?"
Nance asked. The skin on his face was unnaturally taut, a parchment mask. "Where'd you stash the hype, Nance? I need it."
"Deke," she said, trying a tentative smile that instantly vanished. "Deke, that's mine. My hit. I need it for my interview."
He smiled scornfully.
"You got money. You can always score another cap." "Not by Friday. Listen, Deke, this is really important. My whole life is riding on this interview. I need that cap. It's all I got." "Baby, you got the fucking world. Take a look around you. 6 ounces of blonde Lebanese hash, little anchovy fish in tins. Unlimited medical coverage if you need it."
She was backing away from him, stumbling against the static waves of unwashed bedding and wrinkled glossy magazines that crested at the foot of her bed.
"Me? I never had a glimmer of any of this. Never had the kind of edge it takes to get along. Well, this one time, I am gonna. There is a match in 2 hours that I am gonna fucking well win. Do you hear me?"
He was working himself into a rage, and that was good. He needed it for what he had to do. Nance flung up an arm, palm open, but he was ready for that and slapped her hand aside, never even catching a glimpse of the dark tunnel, let alone those little red eyes. Then they were both falling, and he was on top of her, her breath hot and rapid in his face.
"Deke, Deke, I need that shit. take my interview. It's the only... I gotta...
She twisted her face away, crying into the wall.
Please, God, please don't...
Where did you stash it? Pinned against the bed under his body, Nance began to spasm, her entire body convulsing in pain and fear. Where is it? Her face was bloodless, gray corpse flesh, and horror burned in her eyes. Her lips squirmed. It was too late to stop now. He'd crossed over the line. Deke felt revolted and nauseated, all the more so because on some unexpected and unwelcome level, he was enjoying this. Where is it, Nance? And slowly, very gently, he began to stroke her face. Deke summoned Jackman's elevator with a finger that moved as fast and straight as a hornet and landed daintily as a butterfly on the call button. He was full of bouncy energy, and it was all under control. On the way up, he whipped off his shades and chuckled at his reflection in the finger-smudged chrome. The blacks of his eyes were like pinpricks, all but invisible, and still the world was neon bright. Tiny was waiting. The cripple's mouth turned up at the corners into a sweet smile as he took in Deke's irises, the exaggerated calm of his motions, the unsuccessful attempt to mime an undrugged clumsiness.
Well, he said in that girlish voice, looks like I have a treat in store for me.
The Max was draped over one tube of the wheelchair. Deke took up position and bowed, not quite mockingly. Let's fly. As Challenger, he flew defense. He materialized his planes at a conservative altitude, high enough to dive, low enough to have warning when Tiny attacked. He waited. The crowd tipped him. A fat boy with brilliantined hair looked startled. A hollow-eyed cracker started to smile. Murmurs rose. Eyes shifted slow motion in heads frozen by hyped-up reaction time. Took maybe 3 nanoseconds to pinpoint the source of attack. Deke whipped his head up and... Son of a bitch, he was blind. The Fokkers were diving straight from the 200-watt bulb, and Tiny had suckered him into staring right at it. His vision whited out. Deke squeezed lids tight over welling tears and frantically held visualization. He split his flight, curving 2 biplanes right, 1 left, immediately twisting each a half turn, then back again. He had to dodge randomly. He couldn't tell where the hostile warbirds were. Tiny chuckled. Deke could hear him through the sounds of the crowd, the cheering and cursing and slapping down of coins that seemed to syncopate independent of the ebb and flow of the duel. When his vision returned an instant later, a Spad was in flames and falling. Fokkers tailed his surviving planes, 1 on 1 and 2 on the other. 3 seconds into the game, and he was down 1. Dodging to keep Tiny from pinning tracers on him, he looped the single pursued plane about and drove the other toward the blind spot between Tiny and the light bulb. Tiny's expression went very calm. The faintest shadow of disappointment, of contempt even, was swallowed up by tranquility. He tracked the planes blandly, waiting for Deke to make his turn. Then, just short of the blind spot, Deke shoved his Spad into a dive, the Fokkers overshooting and banking wildly to either side, twisting around to regain position. The Spad swooped down on the 3rd Fokker, pulled into position by Deke's other plane. Fire strafed wings and crimson fuselage. For an instant, nothing happened, and Deke thought he had a fluke miss. Then the little red mother veered left and went down, trailing black, oily smoke. Tiny frowned, small lines of displeasure marring the perfection of his mouth. Deke smiled. 1 even, and Tiny held position.
Both spads were tailed closely. Deke swung them wide and then pulled them together from opposite sides of the table. He drove them straight for each other, neutralizing Tiny's advantage. Neither could fire without endangering his own planes. Deke cranked his machines up to top speed, slamming them at each other's nose. An instant before they crashed, Deke sent the planes over and under one another, opening fire on the Fokkers and twisting away. Tiny was ready. Fire filled the air. Then one blue and one red plane soared free, heading in opposite directions. Behind them, two biplanes tangled in midair. Wings touched, slewed about, and the planes crumpled. They fell together, almost straight down, to the green felt below. 10 seconds in, and four planes down. A black vet pursed his lips and blew softly. Someone else shook his head in disbelief. Tiny was sitting straight and a little forward in his wheelchair, eyes intense and unblinking, soft hands plucking feebly at the grips. None of that amused and detached bullshit now. His attention was riveted on the game. The kickers, the table, Jackman's itself might not exist at all for him. Bobby Earl Klein laid a hand on his shoulder. Tiny didn't notice. The planes were at opposite ends of the room, laboriously gaining altitude. Deke jammed his against the ceiling, dim through the smoky haze. He spared Tiny a quick glance, and their eyes locked. Cold against cold. "Let's see your best," Deke muttered through clenched teeth. They drove their planes together. The hype was peaking now, and Deke could see Tiny's tracers crawling through the air between the planes. He had to put his spad into the line of fire to get off a fair burst, then twist and bank so the Fokker's bullets would slip by his undercarriage. Tiny was every bit as hot, dodging Deke's fire and passing so close to the spad, their landing gears almost tangled as they passed. Deke was looping his spad in a punishingly tight turn when the hallucinations hit. The felt writhed and twisted, became the green hell of Bolivian rainforest that Tiny had flown combat over. The walls receded to gray infinity, and he felt the metal confinement of a cybernetic jump jet close in around him. But Deke had done his homework. He was expecting the hallucinations, and knew he could deal with them. The military would never pass on a drug that couldn't be fought through. Spad and Fokker looped into another pass. He could read the tensions in Tiny Montgomery's face, the echoes of combat in deep jungle sky. They drove their planes together, feeling the torqued tensions that fed straight from instrumentation to hindbrain, the adrenaline pumps kicking in behind the armpits, the cold, fast freedom of airflow over jet skin mingling with the smells of hot metal and fear sweat. Tracers tore past his face, and he pulled back, seeing the spad zoom by the Fokker again, both untouched. The kickers were just going ape, waving hats and stomping feet, acting like God's own fools. Deke locked glances with Tiny again. Malice rose up in him, and though his every nerve was taut as the carbon crystal whiskers that kept the jump jets from falling apart in Superman turns over the Andes, he counterfeited a casual smile and winked, jerking his head slightly to one side, as if to say, "Look a here." Tiny glanced to the side. It was only for a fraction of a second, but that was enough. Deke pulled as fast and tight an Immelmann, right on the edge of theoretical tolerance, as had ever been seen on the circuit, and he was hanging on Tiny's tail. "Let's see you get out of this one, sucker." Tiny rammed his plane straight down at the green, and Deke followed after. He held his fire. He had Tiny where he wanted him. Running, just like he'd been on his every combat mission. High on exhilaration and hype, maybe, but running scared,
They were down to the felt now, flying treetop level. Brake, Deke thought, and jacked up the speed. Peripherally, he could see Bobby Earl Klein, and there was a funny look on the man's face. A pleading kind of look. Tiny's composure was shot. His face was twisted and tormented. Now Tiny panicked and dove his plane in among the crowd. The biplanes looped and twisted between the kickers. Some jerked back involuntarily, and others laughingly swatted at them with their hands. But there was a hot glint of terror in Tiny's eyes that spoke of an eternity of fear and confinement, two edges sawing away at each other endlessly. The fear was death in the air, the confinement a locking away in metal, first of the aircraft, then of the chair. Deke could read it all in his face. Combat was the only out Tiny had had, and he'd taken it every chance he got, until some anonymous nationalista with an antique Sam tore him out of that blue-green Bolivian sky and slammed him straight down to Richmond Road and Jackman's, and the smiling killer boy he faced this one last time across the faded cloth. Deke rocked up on his toes, face burning with that million-dollar smile that was the trademark of the drug that had already fried Tiny before anyone even bothered to blow him out of the sky in a hot tangle of metal and mangled flesh. It all came together then. He saw that flying was all that held Tiny together. That daily brush of fingertips against death, and then rising up from the metal coffin alive again. He'd been holding back collapse by sheer force of will. Break that willpower, and mortality would come pouring out and drown him. Tiny would lean over and throw up in his own lap. And Deke drove it home. There was a moment of stunned silence as Tiny's last plane vanished in a flash of light. "I did it," Deke whispered. Then, louder, "Son of a bitch, I did it!" Across the table from him, Tiny twisted in his chair, arms jerking spastically, his head lolled over on one shoulder. Behind him, Bobby Earl Klein stared straight at Deke, his eyes hot coals. The gambler snatched up the Max and wrapped its ribbon around a stack of laminateds. Without warning, he flung the bundle at Deke's face. Effortlessly, casually, Deke plucked it from the air. For an instant, then, it looked like the gambler would come at him right across the pool table. He was stopped by a tug on his sleeve.
"Bobby Earl,"
Tiny whispered, his voice choking with humiliation.
"You gotta get me out of here."
Stiffly, angrily, Klein wheeled his friend around and then away into shadow. Deke threw back his head and laughed. By God, he felt good. He stuffed the Max into a shirt pocket where it hung cold and heavy, the money he crammed into his jeans. Man, he had to jump with it, his triumph leaping up through him like a wild thing, fine and strong as the flanks of a buck in the deep woods he'd seen from a greyhound once, and for this one moment it seemed that everything was worth it somehow, all the pain and misery he'd gone through to finally win. But Jackman's was silent. Nobody cheered. Nobody crowded around to congratulate him. He sobered, and silent, hostile faces swam into focus. Not one of these kickers was on his side. They radiated contempt, even hatred. For an interminably drawn-out moment, the air trembled with potential violence. And then someone turned to the side, hawked up phlegm, and spat on the floor. The crowd broke up, muttering, one by one, drifting into the darkness. Deke didn't move. A muscle in one leg began to twitch, harbinger of the coming hype crash.
The top of his head felt numb, and there was an awful taste in his mouth. For a second, he had to hang on to the table with both hands to keep from falling down forever into the living shadow beneath him as he hung impaled by the prize buck's dead eyes in the photo under the Dr. Pepper clock. A little adrenaline would pull him out of this. He needed to celebrate, to get drunk or stoned and talk it up, going over the victory time and again, contradicting himself, making up details, laughing and bragging. A starry old night like this called for big talk. But standing there, with all of Jackman's silent and vast and empty around him, he realized suddenly that he had nobody left to tell it to. Nobody at all.